There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
News and views from Haiti calling you on the air today for a special broadcast commemorating the 5th anniversary of the coup in Haiti. We'll be talking to lawyers, human rights defenders, union advocates, union activists, and people about the consequences of the coup for Haiti and for Canadian foreign policy 5 years after the overthrow. So stay tuned for 4 packed hours of resistance. Thanks for listening to CKUT. Welcome back to all our listeners on this snowy afternoon, February 26th. This is Radio Résistance News and Views from Haiti, coming to you for a special broadcast. We have a whole crew working behind us tirelessly. Many thanks. And we are Chris and Steve here in the studio.
Yes, the four-hour special, so everybody will finally get the inside and know everything about that coup d'etat that happened in 2004. Against the people of Haiti, you know what I mean?
We're calling it 4 hours of power.
4 hours. And it's to commemorate not like as if it's a good thing, but, you know, it's the 5th anniversary. It happened 5 years ago. And remember 5 years ago how they said they, you know, they were going to build roads and things were supposed to be going well and everything. And now we see what happened. Schools are collapsing and...
5 years of resistance and the country's been hit by hurricanes and no one's been investing in infrastructure. In fact, the UN forces, they're occupying schools as we speak. They're billeting their officers in schools and saying that's helping the country. Yeah. We have really 4 hours, and it's going to take at least 4 hours to really work through for people what happened in Haiti in 2004, what the government was that was in place then, why Canada and other foreign powers decided to destabilize and overthrow it, and what that's meant for the people of Haiti since then. We really have a packed show for you today. We're going to be having later on a panel discussion with members of the Canada Haiti Action Network. We're going to be talking to activists including Jean Saint-Ville in Ottawa, Lucie Tondreau in Miami. We'll also be having some interviews live interviews on the phone from Haiti, if all goes well. And so we really have an explanation of what happened. Say it's been 5 years, but the Haitian people haven't stopped resisting for one day. There have been demonstrations in the streets. There have been lawyers that are carrying on human rights cases, sometimes risking their lives. So we're really here to celebrate the resistance, obviously not to celebrate what happened in 2004, but to celebrate the resistance and to show how that resistance will continue and how perhaps activists in Canada can be aware of it and can even make some positive change in terms of our own country's foreign policy and in terms of the foreign policy and the assumptions which sometimes govern NGOs in Canada, some of the less progressive unions in Canada.
Yeah.
So we're really going to sort of doing a dissection of the problem and trying to find solutions. Steve, this was 4 or 5 years ago, of course, this week, then February 29th, 2004, that the Haiti's democratic experiment was overthrown by former soldiers, backed by Canadian and American and French troops. Yeah. The people that did the coup, your sense of it, man, what was their agenda? Why did they decide to overthrow this popular government?
I think that I could speak for the people that participated. I think that was inside the Haitian community, or should I say that was inside the country, the elite. A lot of them, I think, did it because they thought that they could, you know, stop the progress of people try to bring something new to the country. You know, because they didn't want to pay taxes and, you know, having to pay the employees, you know, higher raises. This is not something that interested us. So they thought that, okay, you know, we'll just get rid of this democracy that people are trying to get for themselves and then keep going on, and then we'll keep living our lives and things will go be better. And some of them actually, and I think a lot of them even thought that, you know, countries like Canada and imperialistic countries would go there to actually help them. When we see, like, everywhere around the world, when these countries are somewhere, you know, they're there for like 10, 20 years, 15 years, but there's never no progress. So the question is, are they really there to help, or are they really there to help themselves? You know, so I think a lot of people believe that. And now, like I was telling a lot of people, I see that there's a tendency, especially in the Haitian community, where people are kind of seeing, well, it's true. You know, they said 5 years ago that things are supposed to be better, and now it's even worse. So people are like, okay, what is this whole thing all about? And so that's pretty much the thing. I think that these people, they did it thinking that it would be, you know, something good for them or for their own personal life. But in reality, they're losing, you know.
Yeah. And you talked about economics and economic choices, too. And I think that's a really important part of it. Things like taxes, things like distribution of wealth in the country.
Distribution kind of wealth, exactly. And I think that one of the reasons countries, like imperialistic countries, participated in that is because they're not trying to see a country like, you know, Haiti strive and make it by themselves, you know, being like another Venezuela.
We
see what happens with Venezuela.
For real.
You know, and Chavez is no joke. Like, if he knows anybody that represents the imperialistic power that's trying to, you know, do any damage in his country, or that's trying to come and influence in a bad way, he pretty much gets rid of them. So then we get a real representation of what the people of the country want, you know, not just a representation of the elite.
Yeah. And they're afraid of a good example. They're afraid of people actually looking at Haiti and saying, hey, that they can do it.
Maybe
we should do it in Nicaragua too. Maybe we should ask for higher wages too, you know?
I mean, it's like, that's what happened in 1804. I mean, when they got rid of slavery, you know, and then, you know, the Toussaint Louverture and the Dessalines, you know, forever be respected. When they created this first black republic, and I should even say this first free republic.
Yeah.
They say first black republic, but it was really the first free republic, because that was the only, well, of the Western, should I say, of the Americas, because that was the only country where everybody was supposed to be equal according to the laws, you know. Even in America, slavery was still happening.
You know,
so then for them to do that, and then what happened? Other countries said, well, you know, if they're free, we want to be free too. So what's going to happen if this country rolls and get their thing happening without these aids and all that stuff? Others would do the same thing. So where are we going to get our gold now? Where are we going to, you know, where are we going to get our sweatshop? Where are we going to put our sweatshops at? So this is a question that people really got to start, you know, asking themselves. You know, the facts are there. You know, there's a lot of reports that came out. And this is what it pretty much suggests, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Haiti's been very scary for imperialist countries and people that want to make a cheap buck for off other people's backs for a long time.
You know.
So what we're going to do is we're going to spend the next 4 hours talking about exactly that. And we're going to start, I think, with an interview we did this week with one of the main activists, so with the Canada-Haiti Action Network. And we'll be giving the coordinates, the addresses, the contact info for all sorts of groups that you can contact after the show. If you want to read up on more, if you want to find some of these books we're referring to in our program. So we're going to talk to the Canada Haiti Action Network representative Jean Saint-Ville, who is a member of the Haitian community and an activist with the Canada Haiti Action Network, has been on this show before. He lives in Ottawa, and if anyone is interested, actually, there is a he'll be giving a talk or hosting a series of talks this Saturday in Ottawa, and we'll be giving you the directions for that before the end of the show. Just before we go into the interview with Jean Saint-Ville, we'd like to also thank two other stations that are carrying or will be carrying this special broadcast.
Thanks to y'all.
Yeah, CKDU in Halifax, Dalhousie campus, and also Make Contact, which is a network of radio stations in the United States. So they're going to be covering this or carrying this show in whole or in part over the next week or so. So thanks, of course, and thanks to the shows that normally would have been played on CKUT today that generously gave us their space. This would be Upstage, Gray Matters, and Dromotex carrying you through until 9 o'clock. So thank you so much, and thanks for the station, of course, for making this possible and all the special help you've been having, including up to the minute, we should say. So let's go into the interview with Jean Saint-Ville talking about why Canadians today should remember the coup in Haiti and what it was all about. can tell our listeners that it's been 5 years now since the government of Haiti was overthrown in a coup d'etat in the year 2004. Why should Canadians today be concerned or remember what happened in Haiti?
Well, one first reason is that Canada played a big role in the decision to overthrow the government of Haiti in 2004. And two, Canada has since been quite involved in the politics of Haiti, beyond the fact that when you go on the website of the government or on CEDA, you'll see that Canada has invested a lot of money in Haiti under the title of aid. But there's more to it than that. In fact, 1 year before the coup, right here in Gatineau, Meech Lake, there was a meeting titled the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti that took place on January 31st, February 1st, 2003, under the auspices of Denis Paradis, who was then Minister for La Francophonie, who invited a number of diplomats from France, other countries in Europe, from the United States, and they made some serious decisions about the future of Haiti. In March of 2003, in the paper L'Actualité, Michel Vastel published an article titled Haiti Put Under UN Tutelage. And mind you, this was 1 full year before the coup. The coup was to happen February 29th, 2004. And basically everything that was predicted in that article, that the president of Haiti was going to be overthrown, Haiti was going to be put under UN tutelage, and that Haiti was to get a new police force and new army. All of that has taken place except for the fact that the new army that Haiti currently has is a UN army force, and that it is holding the place of the traditional Haitian army that has been used for years by the local elite to keep the populace in its place. Now, as is the case when any foreign power invades another place, it has a discourse of aid, of coming to the rescue of the natives. So I'm saying that when Canada participated in this decision to overthrow the government of Haiti, it was the responsibility to protect that was invoked. That is that Haiti was in trouble, therefore Canada intervened to help the Haitians. Except that 5 years after the fact, all the indicators are showing that the situation socioeconomically is even worse than it was back in 2004. So Canadians should be very, very interested in understanding what is happening in Haiti and what our tax money is being used to do in that country.
Could you just, going back for a sec, tell listeners, when Canada decided to overthrow the government of Haiti and that subsequently came about, what actually happened on the ground in the days leading up to February 29th, 2004? Who were the forces on the ground? Who did what to oust the president and the regime?
Okay, now there are many forces, right? You can look at the diplomatic front, which is where most of the action was really taking place, and you can look on the ground in Haiti what was happening with a small group of what was being described on Radio-Canada almost on a daily basis. They were being given interviews. And the leader of that rebellion was identified as Guy Philippe, a former police chief in Port-au-Prince, who has conducted previous coup attempts in 2000, namely against President René Garcia-Préval, and who is said to be on the CIA payroll. And Guy Philippe, who left Haiti back in 2000, said that he was not involved in the coup, although intelligence information that the government of Haiti obtained proved that he was involved in the coup. So Guy Philippe fled via the Dominican Republic and then to Ecuador. And in 2001, came back and conducted other coup attempts. And in 2003, we started seeing situations in Haiti where one of the electric dams, hydroelectric dams, was sabotaged, and police officers were being killed in remote towns. And so the month of February 2004, we started seeing many incursions, especially in the border towns with the Dominican Republic, and eventually they entered the city of Gonaïves and Cap-Haïtien. But what was happening on the ground is that the Port-au-Prince area, where Jean-Bertrand Aristide has a lot of support, and his government also has support in the poor neighborhoods like Cité Soleil and Bel Air, some of the supporters of the government armed themselves and were being used as reinforcement to the police, and therefore the coup leaders could not enter Port-au-Prince. And that's when I remember I was right here in Ottawa monitoring this on the internet, and the night of the coup, the 28th of February, around 9 p.m., I saw an email on a pro-coup site. And so on that website, at 9 p.m. on the February 28th, I saw a post saying that the Americans came to get the president out, and the president is going to give his resignation speech in a few minutes. Helicopters are actually landing. And so we were looking all over the place trying to find confirmation of that information, and we couldn't find it anywhere. And in the morning of the 29th, that's when the media started to report that the president has fled Haiti, has resigned, and basically all the official lines were saying that. And as you know, hours later, many hours later, we were to hear from President Jean-Bertrand Aristide himself, all the way from the Central African Republic, reporting on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, that he was effectively taken out of his house by U.S. Marines. And later on, the president was explaining that during the time they were flying, he didn't know where they were taking him, and the plane windows were shut down, so he couldn't see outside and had no access to a telephone, and the phone that he was using to call Amy Goodman was smuggled to him, and effectively he considered that he was kidnapped.
Sounds like a very bad novel, but it's true. I mean, could you tell us a bit about President Aristide, his political platform and his party's platform? What was it about this platform that was different from the way politics had been done in Haiti until he came to power?
Well, to do that, we'd really have to go back to 1991 when President Aristide took office after the elections of December 16th, 1990, which was after several years of Haiti trying to organize elections and have a democratic government in power. And so President Aristide won these elections with 67% of the votes and became president, sworn in 7th of February, 1991. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he came to power at the same time as Bush the Elder became president of the United States. Mm. And as you know, Bush the Elder was a former director of the CIA. And so it took only 7 months for the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide to be overthrown. Okay, so what was the threat? Jean-Bertrand Aristide is a liberation theologian, grew up with the ideals of Leonardo Boff and, you know, all these guys who really had the theory of liberation theology in Latin America. And for the first time, a liberation theologian became the head of state. There started to be people in the poor parts of the country who become emboldened and wanted to get involved in literacy, massive literacy programs, etc. So when the overthrow took place in 1991, which was a military coup, President Aristide ended up going to Venezuela and then eventually to the United States in exile. And it is when a change in government in the United States happened, when Bill Clinton became president, that an opening was made, especially through the Congressional Black Caucus. Mm-hmm. However, the cynical ploy that took place at that time was that the exile of Jean-Bertrand Aristide was used as an opportunity to negotiate a economic platform for Haiti that was more in line with what the United States, France, and Canada wanted. But what anybody with half a brain would understand was not appropriate for the situation of Haiti. Mm. So President Aristide was asked to accept a IMF structural adjustment program that has proven to be disastrous in all kinds of other situations in return for the possibility of the United States returning him to power at the end of his mandate in 1994-95.
I see. And then perhaps going forward to Aristide's second mandate starting in 2001, we know that in the interim, René Garcia Préval was president. What was the political platform of Aristide's government in 2001, 2002, and 2003, and going into 2004? What was in this program that was so threatening to the to those same big powers you just mentioned?
Well, okay, I'm not so sure if it's really about the platform of President Aristide that caused him to be such a threat to the interests of the local elites in Haiti and the moneyed class in the United States or Europe. There are some irritants in his program. When President Aristide returned to Haiti, subdued as he was, he did two things that could be considered independent actions. First, he resumed diplomatic relationships with Cuba. Mm. Now, in 2004, the coup could not be conducted by the army because the second action that President Aristide took after renewing diplomatic relationships with Cuba was to disband the so-called Haitian army, Les Forces Armées d'Haïti. Mm. Jean-Bertrand Aristide's mandate or his platform is not really what was a threat to these people, but rather the people that put Jean-Bertrand Aristide where he was sitting. That is, he came to represent disorder, and that disorder means that the ruling elite cannot have their little world the way they would like it anymore, because any time, if there is democracy in Haiti, if these people without shoes, as they call them, les sans souliers, the people whose pants have holes, these people, if they are empowered, if they are able to choose their elected officials, then they start getting ideas about influencing what is considered to be the priority of the country. Or, for instance, they might decide that they don't want to work for minimum wage anymore. Yet, whenever the people in a small minority in Haiti, who are mostly importers of goods, of food goods, but they also have a few sweatshop factories who pay people less than $2 a day. Well, if you want to keep cheap labor, you need to keep an impoverished and uneducated population. Mm. And therefore, a government that is going to invest in education and healthcare as opposed to investing in building more sweatshops and giving more advantages to the private sector, that's not going to be a government that you want to support.
And, of course, President Aristide also did try to raise the minimum wage, which must have been an irritant at least. Is that true?
Absolutely, absolutely. But again, I stress the fact that it wasn't Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the individual, although there were some racist reasons also why they didn't like him. He was too black, he was too all of that, and he was too pro-Vaudou as a former Catholic priest and all of that. But the fact that he for some of them, represented a threat to the model of economic structure of the country, was annoying to them. Having said that, Jean-Bertrand Aristide was far from being the radical that a normal president in Haiti would have to be.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you go to Haiti, you look at the abject poverty there, you don't need to be a genius to see that the priority has to be in the basic infrastructure of the nation that is going to benefit everybody. In other words, as a privileged Haitian, I may want to have high-speed internet in my house, but you know, any reasonable person would see that my desire to have high-speed internet must come after the necessity for people to have drinking water.
Yeah.
And those are the kind of priorities that clash and that have been clashing for hundreds of years in Haiti.
You say you're a rude boy. You also say you can't go to jail. But you live in a glass house, so don't throw stones.
Aaron Lakoff, independent journalist, activist, and DJ, has been volunteering at CKUT since 2002.
How do you guys feel about that?
Over the past 7 years, Aaron has participated on the station's steering and programming committees, helped to train new volunteers in the use of our on-air studio, and been an active member of CKUT's Community News Collective.
Across Canada and around the world, this is CKUT's Aaron Lakoff reporting from Montreal.
Aaron's weekly music program, Roots Rock Rebel, delivers a blend of reggae, ska, and punk each Wednesday night from 10 p.m. to midnight.
All right. Hello, hello. You're tuned in to Roots Rock Rebel, CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Aaron. We got some tropical weather tonight. It might be the end of the world, but it's certainly not the end of good radio.
This February, CKUT's programming committee celebrates Aaron Lakoff's contributions to CKUT. Congratulations, Aaron.
Rudy, a message to you, Rudy. A message to you.
Of the rhythm of Haiti, we took from the Manting community of Balan in the north of Haiti. We're going to test Haiti with their rhythm.
5 years ago, February 2004, Haiti's experiment in popular democracy ended when rebels backed by the Canadian forces seized the capital. President Aristide right down to hundreds of local elected officials were deposed in the coup, wreaking havoc on the small nation of 9 million people. During the reign of terror, activists and union leaders were assaulted, arrested, and killed. In the following years, food prices have soared out of reach of most Haitians. Natural disasters have stalked the country. and any initiative to cancel the crippling debt facing the country has been held up by the international community. While Haiti has been stiffed for millions promised in foreign development aid, millions of dollars have been poured into the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti, or MINUSTAH. For Haitians, this has meant a 9,000-member foreign police and military force occupying their country. 5 years later, the stirrings of a popular movement are again being felt. You are tuned in to CKUT's special 4-hour broadcast, Haiti Since the Coup, 4 hours of power, 5 years of resistance. Over the course of these 4 hours, you will be hearing from activists, union leaders, progressive politicians, and average Haitians speaking about the struggle for a new Haiti, a struggle for wage reform, education, and against the structural adjustment program, Canada's other untalked of occupation. Stay tuned as we explore Canada's role in Haiti and highlight Haitian resistance.
Yes.
Welcome back, everyone, to 4 hours of power, 5 years of resistance. This is Radio Résistance, news and views from Haiti. We are half an hour into four packed hours of coverage for you in the studio, Chris and Steve.
Yes.
We were just listening to activist Jean Saint-Ville talking about why Canadians should remember the coup, what the Aristide government in Haiti was trying to do. One thing that was alluded to in Jean's interview is President Aristide was actually overthrown twice, in 1991 by the Haitian army and in 2004 by rebels backed by the foreign powers, Canada, the U.S., and France. For a president to be overthrown twice, that's practically a record. I mean, usually you hear about presidents being overthrown once, and that's the end of it. But obviously, the international community really had, and the Haitian elite really had something to, an axe to grind with Aristide. And often when we talk to people in Montreal, people often say, oh, Aristide was this, Aristide was that, and they all focus on the individuality of Aristide. But what was what's important to remember is there was an entire government apparatus in Haiti, an entire political party, an entire platform. There were 7,000 elected officials, everyone from senators down to mayors that were also overthrown in the coup.
Exactly. So if they had a problem with one guy, why is it that they overthrew the whole, you know, everybody that had to do something with the Lavalas movement and party? It doesn't make any sense, you know?
Well, the Lavalas movement was obviously representing the 90% of Haitians.
Of the people, exactly.
And it was the 10% of Haitians that were making an easy buck, really, that had a problem with that. And as you said, the real purpose of this overthrow was to change the economic agenda of the Haitian government, was to stop this bad example from the point of view of the imperialist powers from spreading to other countries like Nicaragua, Belize, Jamaica, all the other countries that were facing the same problems of Haiti, problems of debt, problems of structural adjustment policies, really, of being forced to downsize their state. And obviously, Aristide and the Lavalas party and the Haitian people that brought them to power had a different agenda from the agenda of the IMF for their country. What we're going to be doing in the next half hour of this show, we're going to be featuring an interview with a man who has written a book on the Femi Lavalas government called Damming the Flood.
Exactly.
Haiti, Aristide, and the politics of containment. This is an interview with Dr. Peter Hallward, who has written a very long and detailed book about how the foreign powers decided to destabilize Haiti. That's about. So we'll be going into that interview, discussing also some of the platforms of the Aristide and the Femi Lavalas government, and how that created conflict with the powerful nations of this world. So we'll go into that, and we'll come back at the top of the hour for more discussion. Dr. Hallward, in your book, you trace the beginnings of the Lavalas movement back to the 1980s. Can you tell us how Lavalas was different from the other left-wing liberation movements that had existed in Latin America before then?
Well, the first thing is the timing. So it comes about over the course of the 1980s at a time when, in other parts of Latin America, say, more traditional socialist movements were very much on the defensive, in say, Guatemala or El Salvador, or Nicaragua, even, where the Sandinistas had been in power for a stretch, but they were under increasing attack and were forced to defend themselves, you know, over the course of the 1980s. And by the end of the 1980s, they were in a fairly weak position, and they were eventually voted out of power, I think, in 1990, right? So Lavalas comes into being at a time when those movements, more traditional socialist national liberation movements, were being pushed back, and then the more recent movements that we've seen in places like Bolivia and Venezuela, of course, and more recently Ecuador and now Paraguay and so on, hadn't started. So Lavalas comes in at a time when it's very difficult, I suppose, to launch something like a collective movement for radical social and political change. That's the first thing. So they're forced to be a bit more, they're thrown back on their own resources a little more, I think. So on the one hand, it draws on this, on a tradition of shared collective labor and projects, particularly in the countryside and in some of the poorer neighborhoods in the bigger cities in places like Port-au-Prince. And that took on a particular shape in the late and mid to late 80s through the Tileglis, the little churches of liberation theology that became increasingly important in the struggle against the Duvalier dictatorships and then against the army from 1986 when Jean-Claude Duvalier is overthrown. And that, I think, is a particular... This was an important development all across Latin America, particularly in places like Brazil and then later in, say, El Salvador, for example. But only in Haiti did it give rise to a very clear political result through the election of their main spokesperson. Jean Bertrand Aristide was the most prominent liberation theologian in Haiti by 1990, and along with various others, people like Father Adrian and Father Jean-Marie Vincent and several others, he was part of a generation of people who represented a mixture of clear political leadership as well as grassroots social activism and neighborhood-level commitment.
One thing I noticed comparing Lavalas with traditional Marxist movements is Lavalas didn't really seem to have the same premium set on the idea of a vanguard. There's no vanguard class that had to lead the movement or lead the revolution. Was that significant, that lack of vanguard, and that did that perhaps make some of Family Lavalas's strength?
I think that's true to some extent. Certainly, it's not the same kind of class structure. The traditional concept of a working class, like a proletariat or wage, that kind of wage slavery, doesn't really exist on a large scale level in Haiti. There certainly is a wage sector, mainly a sweatshop sector, and it employs, I'm not absolutely sure of the numbers at the moment, but it's somewhere around 30,000-40,000 people, something like that. But it's a very small percentage of the overall labor force, which is a mixture of small farmers, agricultural laborers, and artisans of different kinds, and then people working in the informal economy, and the number of people with a what we would recognize, say, as a kind of this classic proletarian type job, are relatively small. So you don't have that class structure, and the groups that are pushing for that, and there are some, represent a very small slice, I think, of the labor force and certainly of the political. Of the political class, if you like. So I think, yeah, there wasn't really that same industrial base or class base. And then you're right. I think that there wasn't then the same concept of a vanguard. There was certainly a notion of leadership, I think, and part of this coming out, for example, of the Catholic Church, where there certainly was a hierarchy and a leadership structure.
And of course, you mentioned Jean-Bertrand Aristide as the most prominent priest and, I guess, leader of that movement, but there were other leaders. Could you mention one or two other figures who became prominent and were subsequently influential?
Well, someone like Father Jean-Marie Vincent, who was influential in the area in the Northwest, and he was associated particularly with a small farmer or peasant movement that became quite a significant force in the late 1980s, and suffered terrible repression at the hands of the army. Many people were killed, particularly in one notorious massacre in Jean Rabel. And he was an important figure, and he was assassinated in 1993 or 94, I'm not sure when, and that was a very severe loss. he was killed. A number of other priests were killed. Some of Aristide's most prominent backers in, let's say, broadly in civil society or including business, someone like Antoine Mery, who was an important and influential businessman who supported Lavalas very strongly. There were a number of other people who became prominent, certainly within the movement. Someone like René Préval, for example, who became the prime minister and who was an agronomist and a baker, not a traditional politician, but a veteran of the popular movement, and he is president now.
If we go back to 1991, when the Lavalas movement took power for the first time, what were the main sort of crying crises that any politician of good faith would have to resolve in the country at the time?
I think the most pressing needs facing a government that came to power in early 1991 were, on the one hand, the legacy, the inheritance of decades, in fact, really of a couple of centuries of what a lot of people have described as a kind of social apartheid, you know, a very strong class polarization between the wealthy few and the great majority of the people, who were treated literally as people from elsewhere, from beyond, in the Muna and the Yo, the people from beyond or outside.
Outside of the capital city.
And they were
city.
Treated as outsiders on all kinds of levels. I mean, and this went very deep. It basically was a way of maintaining a system in which only a very small number of people, five, perhaps the most 10% of people, had any real input into political life. And that, I think, was probably one of the most important issues, was how to empower ordinary people so they could participate in politics, really for the first time. There were, of course, then a number of very, very difficult economic challenges, in particular how to weather the impact of neoliberalism, which became a almost irresistible force all across Latin America. I mean, it happened, for example, very badly in Bolivia and various other places, and affected Haiti as well from the mid-'80s on. Measures that undercut local agriculture in particular and proved very damaging. And Haiti there had very little room to maneuver. In fact, it's dependent on the aid that the same countries who were behind the neoliberal turn provide. And therefore, it was always a matter of trying to find some kind of balance. But that, I think, was a second issue. A third was how to deal with the legacy and the influence of the army, which had become really the oppressor of its own people. That was its real function, was to maintain order and maintain stability, particularly in the countryside. So how do you deal with this force of about 7,000 troops that absorbed a huge amount of the budget that were mainly an obstacle for anything like real political change?
Mm. Maybe you could tell us, facing these gigantic challenges, when Lavalas was in power, both in the early 90s and then through the later 90s, if we take out the period of the first coup, and in 2001-2004, what were the main initiatives in terms of infrastructure, social programs, economics, that Lavalas was able to implant? How did it try to change the way business was done in Haiti?
Well, they did a number of things. First, you have to acknowledge, though, that before I get to that, they did two very important things, or maybe even three.
Mm-hmm.
One is that they were quite sensible, I think. I mean, in some ways, maybe some people would say too moderate, I don't know, but they managed to play the game within the rules set by the international community up to a point. So they worked with the IMF, for example, relatively successfully, both in 1991 and then again after 2001. In a way that would guarantee that they could, at least in principle, receive international support. And again, you can argue the pros and cons of this strategy, but the fact is that Haiti is just so poor and is so desperately in need of aid that I think they have no real choice. I mean, the budget, typically they were receiving more than half their budget, often more like two-thirds or even three-quarters of their budget was coming in international aid. And so if you lose that, and if your budget is cut in half, I mean, that's a very serious price to pay, particularly when you're a country that's already living at the edge of starvation.
Mm.
So one of the things that's quite noteworthy about the Aristide administration, for example, is that they were very warmly endorsed by the IMF on a number of different levels, for being financially sound, for example, for raising taxes from the wealthy and from businesses that in a way that had never really been done before. And this was brought up, for example, in an IMF report in 2003 that was largely positive in relation to how the Haitian government was managing the economy and so on. And this is at a time when international aid was cut off, because when Arti was elected, re-elected in 2000 and came to power again then in February 2001, all international aid was cut off. The United States basically vetoed, certainly it cut off all its own aid, and then it cut off aid that had been promised to Haiti by the Inter-American Development Bank, very significant amounts of money, again amounting to effectively about half the budget of the country, was cut off immediately. And so to manage the economy reasonably well at such a period, and to set the ground at least for future loans and future aid, was no small achievement all by itself. So that was the first thing. The second thing is that they dealt with these two other problems that they had back in 1991. They got rid of the army. Arti comes back in 94, and within a couple of months, so by early 1995, he managed to disband the bulk of the army, and by April 95, he's got rid of the whole thing. And he sets in motion a process where these troops would be demobilized, a certain number of them would be brought into a replacement civil police force, the others were given job training and opportunities to find other kinds of work. And if that process had been left to run its course without international interference, that could have made a really major difference. Even as it was a very popular measure, perhaps the single most popular thing that Arti ever did. Of course, though, it ran into trouble right away, because the United States was very reluctant to see this allowed to come to pass, and were very keen to influence the development of this new police force, and they exercised flagrant control over who would have power in it, and so on. And that became a very serious headache for the Haitian government. Mm-hmm. So that was the second thing. They dealt with the army. And a third thing was they created this new political organization that would allow them to have, for the first time in 2000, a genuine, disciplined parliamentary mandate. They won the elections of 2000, which were legislative elections at every level of government, municipal, parliamentary, and so on. And they won with a huge landslide, about 75% or so of the vote on average, which meant that they had, for example, 72 out of 83 of the seats in the main house in the parliament, and virtually every Senate seat.
Wow.
And with a majority like that, you can accomplish a certain amount. So that was already a huge achievement, and there was no precedent for that in Haitian history. There had never been a party like Samedi-Lavalas that had the resources, the commitment, the people, the program. You know, they spent several years developing a program called Investing in People, Investir dans l'Humain.
Tell us a little bit about that program, Investir dans l'Humain, yeah.
The program was, in a way, what you'd expect. It was investments in health and education, which were, if you take the case of education, for example, along building on what the Préval administration had done just before Arti was reelected. They built 195 new primary schools and about 100, maybe 104 altogether, new secondary schools. And that was, so between them, that, from 1996 and to 2004, then 104 new secondary schools, building on an initial total of just 34, you know, government secondary schools. A huge increase. I mean, it's vastly more than had been done before them. And this had some significant effect. That built, building on a literacy program that was also launched at the same time in 2001, managed to reduce illiteracy from, again, you know, it's hard to be absolutely sure about the figures, but the standard figure is something like it went down from about 65% to about 45%. And that's a significant achievement, and there's still a lot to be done, but I think that's important. There were important developments also at the level of health care. For example, a new university and medical school built, the University of Tabar, on the edge of Port-au-Prince. Developments like that, there was hospitals were revamped, a couple of new clinics were started. There were some small but significant steps forward in, for example, the treatment of HIV and tuberculosis and some other illnesses, at a time when the Haitian government resources were very dramatically reduced. I'd say the second Arti government took modest but significant steps forward on a number of fronts. For example, it accelerated the process of judicial reform and the reform of the judicial and penal system, so that people came to trial more quickly, that prisons were not too overcrowded, legal services and trials would take place more frequently in Creole and not simply in French. A number of new judges, more than 100 new judges were trained. There were, you know, the whole process of of the criminal justice system was accelerated, and this is, I think, a significant step forward.
You mentioned abolishing the army as the main achievement that people remembered from the first Aristide administration. Is there one achievement that similarly stands out for the years 2001 to 2004?
I don't think there's anything quite as spectacular, but I think the combination of the launching of a literacy program that was significant and widespread around the figure that I'm familiar with, about 300,000 or so people participated, and the launching of creation of some new schools, the building of about 50 or so new public squares, for example, public spaces in particularly in Port-au-Prince, which is a very crowded city, and to create a new public square, for example, on the edge of neighborhoods like Bel Air and in the center of Sidi Soleil and various others, is a huge improvement to the life of the people who live there. I think there were investments in public housing. Again, not massive. I think there were about 1,000 or so units built in 2002, 2003 in Port-au-Prince. But again, at a time when the budget was minuscule and had been cut effectively in half. And in the light of that, I think the Aristide government, it didn't accomplish spectacular things, I don't think, but it took significant steps forward, and it made small but important improvements and advanced an agenda towards something like, something closer to a kind of political stability in which slowly but surely you could work for meaningful social change in Haiti. That's what it was able to achieve. That was, I think, a realistic and significant agenda, and even that, I think, was in a way unacceptably threatening to the establishment in Haiti.
In your book, Peter, you mentioned the effect of privatization and Aristide's approach to the demands that were made of him to privatize various state-owned companies. After he was overthrown, Aristide mentioned in an interview with Naomi Klein that privatization was really the reason the international donor nations cut off funding to him and subsequently chose to overthrow him. Is that what you understand? You said that his program, modest as it was too threatening for the international community. What was it that they found so threatening?
Well, privatization is certainly an important factor. I'm not sure if it's the only factor or even if it was really the most, but it's certainly an important one. For a couple of reasons. One is simply the fact of simple obedience and power. An agenda is set, and if a government resists, what was virtually a global trend towards the privatization of public resources and the downsizing of governments and the creation for new opportunities for private enterprise to exploit the situation and opportunities that they found, I could find. I think that by itself was a kind of affront to the tendency of the time. Remember the big picture. Haiti is a very poor country, and it has only a few sources of revenue. It doesn't have, at least at the moment, it doesn't have particularly valuable natural resources. Its capacity to levy tariffs and raise taxes is extremely limited. And one of the only real sources of revenue it has, then, are the few public enterprises and public resources that it still owns. There's a national telephone company. There are national ports. There used to be a cement mill and a sugar mill and a flour mill. And there are the airports and a couple of things, one or two things like that, an electricity company. And that's about it. And these provide very important revenue, very significant revenue to the government. And one of the things that the international community then wanted to do when Aristide came back in 1994 was to force him into the process of privatizing all of these industries. And agreements were made, the so-called Paris agreements, where basically a gun was put to Aristide's head. I mean, pretty literally, the supporters are being killed and he was forced to agree to a series of measures that would implement this privatization process, but very importantly, under certain conditions. And the conditions, you can read about this, you can find the agreements were published in the Multinational Monitor in the summer of 1994, and you can find them online. And the agreements are pretty explicit, and they involve measures, different kinds of measures for a degree at least of social and economic justice, that the resources from the privatization would be used, for example, to build schools and clinics for the workers, that that they would be sold in such a way that ordinary people could buy, you know, small shares in them, that the government would retain a public stake in them, that they wouldn't simply be sold off, you know, to a wealthy buyer as has happened before in the late 1980s, for example. And these conditions were not met. This became the great controversy, that the international community wanted to push ahead with basically untrammeled privatization. Aristide said no. As a result, he stalled on the privatization. And when he did that, the international community accused him of reneging on the agreements and started to put pressure on international aid and eventually cut it off completely. So the spectrum of political difference over the course of the 1990s increasingly became tagged, I think, to the degree to which a Haitian politician was prepared to go along with this privatization agenda, whether they were prepared to privatize virtually everything, which was the case for the so-called democratic opposition, funded, as it happens, by the United States and other international governments, whether they were prepared to privatize a few of these resources, like Preval was, reluctantly in the late 1990s, or whether, like Aristide, they simply refused to do it unless the conditions were met. And I think that was certainly an important factor in getting rid of Aristide. It meant that Aristide, for example, was able still to use the ports and the telephone company and various other resources as a source of funding for his projects. For example, for some of the money that came through these public resources was used to build the University of Tabar and to fund the literacy program and some of the other programs I mentioned earlier. It also meant that that some jobs could be given to people who were either supportive of the government or who lived in areas that would otherwise not have any access to this kind of jobs. People who live, for example, in places like Cité Soleil and other poor neighborhoods in Port-au-Prince had, a small number of these people had jobs in the ports or in the telephone system. Now, there was some controversy about this, whether these jobs were corrupt or not, or whether people were working as they should have done. And I think it's relatively hard to measure. I'm sure there was some corruption. Of course, there would be some corruption given the situation. But on balance, it meant that people from the poor neighborhoods had an income and had a regular job and had an opportunity to move into the labor force. And I think that was quite significant.
And, of course, one of the things that happened right after the coup and the rebels swept into town in 2004 is a large number of people who had these jobs got fired. Is that right?
That's right. They were fired virtually immediately, and they were fired en masse. They were fired. The entire political system was overthrown. The whole judicial system was overthrown. All those people were thrown out. And that meant that, in very literally, that them and their families in a month or two would be facing starvation.
I wanted to ask you, picking up on something you said a bit earlier, in 1984, Aristide was in exile following the first army coup against him. His supporters were being killed. There were massive human rights abuses. In exile in Washington, Aristide eventually accepts a deal with Clinton by which he will impose certain structural adjustments in exchange for U.S. help in going home in the cover of U.S. troops.